All right, welcome everyone. How are y'all doing?
Good, good.
Good, good. All right. Monday morning.
It is Monday morning. It is.
I'm a rad dad, as you can see.
I don't have one of those cool cups.
I don't either.
My other favorite is one that says, "You don't have to be crazy to work here. We'll train you."
That's pretty good.
I feel like that's
pretty accurate.
That's like the higher ed motto.
We need t-shirts.
Yeah, exactly. Forget the brand of the athletic department. Just start wearing that. So here we are. This is our fourth episode of Getting Stuff Done in Higher Education. And we have the privilege today to learn from our third podcaster, Fritz, and how Fritz got into higher ed and what we all need to know about Fritz so we can all kumbaya around the rest of our episodes that we're going to be doing.
Thanks, guys. Happy to be here. So my path into higher education started late in college. So I went to DePaul University in Indiana. Go Tigers. D3. I graduated in 1998. I was a history major, and I loved it. Loved every minute of it. I had a wonderful advisor named John Schlotterbeck. And he was a 19th century Civil War historian kind of guy. And so I was a history major, and I was an undeclared jazz studies minor. We'll get into all that stuff later, too. But I graduated in 98. I had a job. I got a job at Anderson Consulting. So this is, you know, the run up to Y2K. The tech sector is going nuts. The web is proliferating. What is this thing? What is it going to become? There's no really e-commerce yet. It's not really woven into, you know, you couldn't buy a pack of t-shirts on Target yet. There was no Target.com. So I'm working at Anderson, and I'm thinking this is a good way to start off. I live in Chicago, Lincoln Park. And so, you know, I'm getting tech experience, learning how to code, learning how to build. I'd never coded before, but I was really good in math. It's actually my highest grade in college was calculus freshman year. And so I'm learning a lot, but I'm also realizing, long-term, I don't think this space is for me, you know. It just wasn't really kind of who I was. I grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, in a small suburb out right on the edge of the city called Webster Groves, kind of a 19th century bedroom community that, as the city grew, it just, you know, became part of the metro. So my parents, my dad is from St. Louis. My family's been in St. Louis since like 1830 or something insane. My parents, they settled back there in the early 70s. My dad grew up there, and after his schooling, settled back there in 1971. They still live in their house, same house they've been in since 1971. So, you know, he has a graphic design background, became worked at a small firm. So I've been in the creative world for so long. Between that and my mom, who worked in, I know it sounds weird in St. Louis, but worked in the television and film industry. So you're shooting a commercial, she was the set dresser, or often the set teacher, because she had a teaching license from way back in the 60s. So she had a prop shop. I need a bunch of clothes to make people look like they're from the 1950s. Okay, I got you covered, or whatever. I need a jukebox too, and all this. So I was never really, I didn't grow up with a parents or really anyone who was in the corporate world. My grandfather was a surgeon. His wife was a nurse. So, you know, my dad was a lawyer. I didn't grow up in that kind of world. So I knew it was a good way to start, but I really quickly saw that this isn't the path for me. So I'm thinking about, what am I good at? What do I like? And really the thing I liked the most, I loved being a history major. The research, the writing, the learning, and not that I taught, but so I thought this is the right path for me to be a history professor, because it's what I was really good at it. I did a great senior thesis. I was a runner-up for an award that they had about my thesis about the American Revolution and two businessmen who are on different sides of the conflict. It's out there. If you want a copy, I can get you a copy. So I thought I want to go to graduate school and become a history professor. So I went back to DePauw, drove down from Chicago. This is like the spring of 99. Met with my advisor, John Schlatterbeck, John Dittmer, who I'd become friends with. He, after I graduated, he's like, Fritz, call me John. You don't have to call me Professor Dittmer anymore. And then another professor, a French history professor named Dennis Trinkle, who was 7 years older than me, and he became a really important mentor for me. And all of them said, being his professor is wonderful, but the job market is awful. So this is late 90s. It's bad now. It was bad then. So they said, if you're going to do this, you need to be at the front edge of what technology can do in the field, both in teaching and research. They said, we don't know what it's going to do. It's so early days. But if you can be really at the front edge of that, you have a better chance. There's also a guy named Glenn Keeker, who is a Latin American history prof, who was very important too in this conversation. So I thought, okay, so I'm working at Anderson Consulting. I'm certainly getting the tech skills. I'm going to keep pouring into that. That was more, like corporate clients. So I wanted to do web development because that's really where they said what the web can do in those spaces of research and teaching. Head to that direction. So I pulled the lever I had. My dad, he was the president of a small graphic design firm. I was very close to the vice president since I was in high school, a guy named Rich Murphy. And I said, I want to learn web development. I've got some chops from Anderson. He's like, come work for me. I'll pay you a small salary. But, you know, in St. Louis then, I could get a great apartment for $500 a month or $400 a month in a great part of town by actually pretty close to Washington University. And so I did that. I moved back to St. Louis. And I started applying to grad schools. And I applied to, you know, real programs like Princeton and University of Virginia and University of Indiana or Indiana University. So Washington University. And as I'm building up in this web development space. So, and I got really good advice along the way. So it took me a while to remember, but there was a professor at Indiana named John Bodner, who I went to do a visit because I applied. And he said, whatever you do, don't borrow money. No offense, Kevin. Don't borrow money to do any kind of degree in history or the humanities. Go somewhere where you get funding. I'm like, okay, that's really good advice. So I think I got in there. I don't remember if I got funding from them. I got into UVA. I was accepted. I had some conversations with Ed Ayers, who's like a very important historian of the New South, the post-Civil War Reconstruction era. He was there at the time. I think he was still in the history department. He wasn't a dean yet. He hadn't gone to University of Richmond yet. He was like, I can't offer you funding. I would love to have you with your background, which really sucked because I don't know, who knows what my path would have been had I gone to UVA. Maybe I would have continued. So, but I got a full funding offer from Washington University. It's perfect. It's like seriously less than a mile from where I already lived. So it worked out really well. And so there was a professor there who named Peter Castor. He's still there. I think he's higher up now. I don't know if he's at a dean level, but he directs all the history and American culture studies programs. And we're still in touch occasionally. So if you're listening, Peter, I hope you're well. So he was there and he went to UVA. So he is very much immersed in digital humanities, using the web and teaching and research. So he and I became very connected quickly. And so I walk in and I've got these technology skills that no one has, you know, ASP, Cold Fusion, relational databases, you know, data-enabled websites, which is still new. Like this is pre-Web 2.0 that everyone talked about in the early 2000s. So, he's like, great. The minute I walked in, they're like, oh, you do this stuff? Great, you can do this project. We're trying to develop this online database of these records, and we want to do this program where we teach graduate students how to develop multimedia and presentations, basically short films about their research that's more accessible and that lay people not in the field can understand, so that they're, you know, they know how to talk about their research. So it was great. Like I had all this, I got right to the front of line, all these things. So I'm moving along. I'm in like my first, second year, and I'm realizing, you know, this is really great stuff. I'm really interested in this. And then I'm also realizing how long is that path going to be a history professor to get my degree? You know, it's usually 6-8 years to get a PhD in humanities, which is a long time. And then I really realize as I'm watching other grad students in the program, I will have very little sovereignty over and control over where I'm going to live if I want to get a tenure track job. So I'm like, ooh, I don't know if I want to finish this thing. So I took an off ramp at the master's. I did a master's thesis that I had so much fun writing. It's about the lumber industry in the U.S. South post Civil War, and how it was this confluence of interesting factors like technology, policy related to essentially the forests of the U.S. South were largely held off from being consumed and logged out because of policy during the Reconstruction era, where Confederate veterans could not access it to mine and log because of their affiliation with the rebellion. And so, it really was a large resource for a long time. And so it was basically how that became, how that whole system of, robber barons and lumber barons came into the South, and the local versus national economic factors on it. It was a really fun project. And I learned some really interesting things along the way about the social dynamics of Jim Crow and race, all sorts of interesting things. So I finished. I always joke that I graduated and walked, got my diploma, had my mortarboard on a Saturday, and I joined the staff on Monday. I joined the technology staff of the College of Arts and Sciences this is the spring of 2002. And along the way, in 2001, I became really close to a staff member in that team who had done his PhD in English Comparative Lit, named Gavin Foster. Gavin's CIO at Gettysburg College now. I hope we can have him as a guest sometime, because he's also a really important early mentor. He taught me how to build things in Macromedia Flash back in the day. So Gavin was an important influence on my early career as well. He showed me a lot of what could be done in this space. So, I'm digging into digital humanities and the projects through the university. So I still worked with Peter Castor a lot. So one of the fascinating things is the Circuit Court of St. Louis. This is where the Dred Scott case came through before it went to the Supreme Court in the late 1850s. We call them freedom suits. I don't know if they're still called that, but the two enemies of historical records, they were never burned and they were never flooded. So they were all there. So there was dozens of of freedom suits in the pre-Civil War era. Slaves who were transported to, say, the Minnesota Territory by military personnel or Illinois, and they would sue for their freedom and they would often win. So the real rupture with the Dred Scott case is that he lost at the Supreme Court. Most times those cases, often they won. The minute you touch free soil, you are a free person. So all those records were there, bound up and, in string and wax, the red tape, coal dust in them. So I got to figure out and set a whole process for digitizing them, cataloging them, and making them available online in a partnership with the Missouri Department of, I can't remember the department now, the state, it was in the Secretary of State Office, Historical Records Project. So this is great stuff. I'm the one developing it. So I did things like that for a couple of years. I continue to teach workshops about how to present, how to develop things in Flash so that grad students and faculty could do things. So one really interesting project was Kathleen Muldoon is her name. She developed a small module about the human pelvic floor, which is a really hard topic to teach at that point. I remember her saying, they use coffee filters, and it's hard to visualize unless you're operating on a cadaver. And often in a cadaver, it's not, the anatomy is, it's not well preserved anymore, or something to that effect. So she built this online module that helped visualize it. And an anatomy prof in anthropology used it, wrote a paper about it. So this is really exciting, interesting stuff. Yet I still have this itch. I want to keep going. I didn't necessarily want to be a faculty member, but I wanted to keep building out some kind of career in higher ed at this intersection of technology and topics, humanities, science, wherever. So I think it was in 2004, I was kicking around like, maybe I should just go back in the program at WashU and finish my PhD. So I talked to my advisor, Ivor Bernstein. It's like, yeah, you could do it, you know, yeah. And I remember I met with Dennis Trinkle from DePauw again. At that point, he was CIO at DePauw. He's not a history or a French history professor anymore. And he was at an alumni event. I went to it in St. Louis, and he's like, why don't you just get a doctorate in higher education policy and administration? I'd never heard of this field. I'm like, oh, yeah, because I don't want to be faculty. And I know I could be faculty and then go through the faculty administrative route, dean, all that stuff. It'd be a long path. It's like, no, if you don't want to be faculty, you want to be in the tech side, the academic technology side, just do this route. It'll take you where you want to go. So I started looking at programs.
So Fritz, sorry, real quick. So how did that faculty mentor of yours go from being, how did they become a CIO?
Oh yeah, Dennis, I think he's in our list. We should interview Dennis sometime. So
just real quick, like how did he become a CIO?
French history professor, right? So he got his PhD in the University of Kentucky in mid 90s, started teaching French history. He was an adjunct at DePauw when I was there. Also he was developing coding and games and things as a kid and in high school. So he also had these non-official tech experiences. He wasn't a computer science major, maybe minored or something. So he had this whole corpus of knowledge and experience. And then as he was bringing them together, he saw the same thing. Like, I'm not going to get the path I want, and maybe not the career I want out of a history professor role. So as he was teaching adjunct at DePauw, they're like, you need to keep doing this stuff. So they eventually made him a professor of instructional technology. This is like early 2000s. And then he just kept going towards that route. So then he became CEO at Valparaiso for a while. Then he was back at a state level in Indiana doing this, how to build technology effectively into curricula from K through 16. This is in the mid 2000s, late 2000s. So then he got into the tech sector of workforce development, really. So this is why I think he'd be a really interesting guest sometime, because he's just got this really interesting path.
Yeah.
So apparently at one point he was a wine buyer, so he'd go to France a lot, which sounds like a pretty sweet gig too. It was like a side hustle in grad school or something. So I saw this itch, so I started looking for programs. There was not a program at WashU, doctorate in higher education policy administration or administration. There wasn't a program at SLU, St. Louis University. It wasn't a program at University of Missouri, St. Louis, UMSL. Mizzou had one in Columbia. And I looked at others like Loyola, I think, of Chicago. So at this point, I'm engaged to my now wife, Stephanie. She's finishing grad school in 2005. She has a doctorate in physical therapy from WashU. And so we're looking at where do we want to live, et cetera. And so she's from Minnesota. She's from Duluth, Minnesota. Her parents are from the Iron Range, the Range. So she's younger than me. She's 5 years younger. She was initially, before she met me, she was going to move back up here to the Twin Cities to start her career. And so she said, would you be interested? And then there's a program at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus, the flagship campus of the system. I'm like, this could be good. I applied, I got in. So we're moving to Minnesota. This is 2005. We moved here in May or so of 2005, right after she finished her DPT. So I start, and I'm still really interested in the technology, academic technology, and higher education. So I enter the PhD program, and at the time, I was working for a small, and I've referenced this before, a very small higher education marketing and communications company, tiny, like 5 people, called the Lawler Group. And I was really fortunate. So this is where I first get my look inside the admissions and marketing space of higher ed. I was, I'm 29, 30, I'd never been in that space. So that was a really important education for me. So I started there in the spring of 05. 06, that spring of 06, the university and the department, my advisor, Darwin Hendel, I applied and got a graduate assistantship. So I was doing one course at a time initially in the fall of 05 and my program in the spring of 06. Now I have an opportunity to just plow through this thing. I get a little stipend that'll pay for the mortgage. My tuition's remitted. I took 4 courses a semester for 4 semesters plus summer courses in 07 and just plowed through that coursework because I wanted to get it done. We didn't have kids at that point. We're just married. She's starting her career. You know, it's a good time to do that. So I did that. Spring of 08, I finished my coursework, took my oral prelim, did my written prelim. Fun story. I bombed my written prelim at the first go. I was just too much information. It was those days when you went in a room with a computer that was not connected to the internet. You got three questions and you had to get two of them right. You know, what is, Kolb's theory of student inclusion or whatever. I've forgotten it all. It's all in here. How college affects students. Pascarell and Terenzini, the Bible, which now holds up my computer. So, So then I finished my coursework. I did pass my written and my oral prelim. And my plan was to do research about instructional technology in small colleges, how that's developed, choices made about how to implement it. But then I was very fortunate to get a job at McAllister College in St. Paul here, a small liberal arts college, like 2,000 students, really great institution, you know, in the top, whatever, 20, 30 in the U.S. And in the academic technology side, I am, the role is called Academic Information Associate. They still have them. So we were academic technology support staff by discipline. So I was in the humanities. We had one in the social sciences, languages and fine arts, and the physical sciences, let's call it that. So I started there in the summer of 08. And so I'm in a faculty office in Old Main. So I'm on the English department floor with all the history department, classics, all those folks, philosophy. And so I started there and I was there for 9 years and I had a 9-year really intimate education, in-depth education about all things higher education at small institutions and then bigger, as I'm also doing my research and writing my dissertation. And I had some really important mentors there. One was named Brad Belbus. He was another AIA in social sciences. We called him Papa Bear because he's just retired. And he was a really important mentor for me about how do you do this and do this role and also do research and dissertation at the same time, because he had done his PhD in learning sciences or something to that effect. I'm getting a little rusty. Anyway, so, and this is great. So I'm immersed with faculty all the time. I'm working with faculty. I'm supporting teaching and research. And this is where all the things I've done before. So my academic background in history is important, even though I'm not going to say I just have a master's, but you know, when you're in a world of PhDs and you have a master's, you know, you have to be careful. And when you're in an academic technology role, I learned quickly, not because of big mistakes, but you can never purport to be faculty in a setting like that because it doesn't play well. But they were so amazing and not respectful. They were supportive and they just welcomed me in, you know, like, come to our meetings. They can tell me all the cultural nuance of their world, teaching, research. It was like being a little anthropologist, getting to accompany them in all these spaces. I'm also there, and Brian Rosenberg, who's now a frequent contributor to the Chronicle of Higher Education. He was president from like 03 to 2021. So I'm there in the prime of his presidency, pre-COVID, post-Great Recession, or during and post. So, and faculty meetings were open to all staff. So once a month, I'm at a faculty meeting, just sitting there listening, soaking it in, watching it all happen. And that was like a masterclass in that world. Really important. Seeing how the faculty governance happens, the intersection between the administration, CFO, the president, provost, and the faculty as a body, that tension occasionally and that give and take. It was just a really great 9 years with them. I loved working there. And in a lot of ways, I miss it because, again, I'm in a faculty space. I get to see it all happen. I'm in the classroom with them a lot, working with students. One of my favorite memories is Professor Andy Overman. He's a classics professor, archaeologist, Roman archaeology. But he got really in, so this is a like 2010 or so. He, you know, Middle East peace, Middle East conflict. So he wanted to bring students from Egypt into a conversation with students from Israel remotely. And this is like, Zoom didn't exist. I think we're using Skype. I had a little webcam set up, you know, a microphone set up next to it, putting it up on a screen with a crappy projector. I mean, like holding it together barely. Like I would have to mute our mic when they were talking to drop the feedback. It was, but you know, this is great experience of helping people connect where they normally couldn't connect at all because of political and conflict barriers. So, and that was one of, Andy was kind of skeptical at first. Like, I don't think you're able to do this. I think this is a bad idea. And he became a really great champion and someone who really could see the potential. Another one, Daylan English. I mentioned her before we recorded. She is a professor of African-American literature, and Afrofuturism is her subject and her, you know, her area, her specialty. And she was, you know, everyone was rightfully often skeptical of the role of technology in humanities because of just how technology and human spaces interact over the course of history a lot of skeletons. But, you know, I showed her, look, we can do this. We can portray your scholarship this way or your teaching. And she saw it. She's like, I'm in. This is what I need. Because she wanted to be able to portray, to take clips of media, say of, you know, James Brown or Janelle Monáe or these artists performing and as examples of Afrofuturism and annotate them and do things you just couldn't do on paper. And so she saw the potential of that. So again, she went from being appropriately skeptical to understanding how to co-opt these things, not to be, they're not subject to their whims and they're not controlling your scholarship or your teaching or what you're producing. You're actually controlling them and what they do for your teaching and your scholarship. So I still do that. Let's co-opt this thing. Yeah, you're skeptical of it. So am I, actually, but let's bend it in a way that makes it work for you. Okay, I've been talking a lot. I need a breath. Where do you all want to go? we got to get up to now, right?
Well, so early on, I mean, I think that like there's this fine line between like library science. Like if you think about the stuff you're doing with the Historical Society, collecting all those things, like that's like you could have went the library science route, like really thinking about how to bring, because I mean, that's a whole lot of pieces that they're doing now versus this technology within higher ed. And so I think that piece, I think, is just interesting, like how you made, I guess, a conscious choice to do technology esque things within the higher ed realm versus you could have went almost any, I mean, that was like early tech, right? Like you could have almost went anywhere.
Yeah, I could have. I never really thought about it like that. It was a lot of intersection with library sciences and what they were doing. I learned about like Dublin Core metadata standards, you know, and mm-hmm. how they relate to what we're doing with these freedom suits and the project we're doing to try to make them available. So, oh my gosh, yeah, we have to use a standard for the metadata we're collecting so that it can then be aggregated in and federated with other similar resources. So the American Memory Project was huge back then. I'm assuming it still is, as an example of how do you make giant troves of historical materials available online to the public. It's really, looking back, it was an interesting time. And I could see this string laid out by people who are giving me these little nuggets of information, like my advisors understand technology and how it intersects with what we do. We don't know yet where it's going. We have ideas. Be in that space. Be at the front edge of it. You know, my friend and now colleague, Gavin Foster, who was doing this stuff in the mid-90s, late 90s, when he was working on his doctorate, you know, all those early experiences with faculty at WashU, Peter Castor, another person who could see the space, and it was very undefined, but you could see, I don't know, like I could see this space, like I want to go there. I still, you know, I taught a little bit. I haven't taught enough. And I feel like I've got away with something. I feel like I was able to negotiate around that in a space where I'm with people who teach. McAllister is very teaching focused. Research is very much a part of their tenure and promotion path. Don't get me wrong. But teaching excellence and is part of the experience of being a McAllister student, but research is as well and for faculty. But I was getting entree to these spaces where I'm not going to say I had no right being there. I asked like Andy Overman, who I mentioned, the professor of classics. I remember asking him, how important is it? Because at their points, you guys done this, you're working on a doctorate. Like we had a baby at that point. Oh my gosh. You know, like when am I going to sleep? And there are points when I'm like, do I even finish this thing? You know, like I'm tired. It's a long road. There are these big peaks and troughs of productivity. So I finished my prelims. Then we had a baby and I had a new job. Then I like 09, 10, I did my data collection. And then we like built a house. Then I started doing data analysis and writing. And then we're going to have another baby, you know? So it was long. It was took me. And so I finished my, it took me 5 years after I finished my prelim stuff to defending. So the spring of 13, I finished and defended. It was actually one of the best phases of my career. It was just, everything was great. Not in the world, but for me and my wife, Stephanie, we had a young child. We had another one on the way. I would go down at night and hide in my little office in the basement, put on my lucky hoodie, drop in a pint of chai to like rev my brain up and just write. It was great. I put my headphones on, my good music, then nature sounds that I like to write to. It was like this really insular but really fun time of just being immersed in my little project, my little family. And in the spring of 13, I got to take some parental leave. So Leo, our son, was like 4 months old. And so I took my parental leave at McAllister. And I remember walking around campus at the U, and he is in a stroller, and I had copies of my dissertation in the bottom to take him to my committee members and drop him off. So it was just like this fun little period of life where all was right. You know, I got to finish. It was great. But yeah, I always feel like I've been finding these little areas where, and it's weird to say, people don't think higher is entrepreneurial, but it's this own little entrepreneurialism. Like you see these opportunities and you're like, I want to poke on that and go in that direction, where some people might be like, what are you doing? There's nothing here.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. I loved your description of your path today, because it, you know, it reminds me too of just like some of the things that we've been talking about, just finding those opportunities. Like, you know, when I was trying to, you know, get into online learning, I mean, that was relatively new for me. And there just happened to be, you know, like it would be interesting to actually like look at, if you could go back and look at the Chronicle of Higher Ed around the time that I was looking for that job at Northwestern State, just to see, well, how many directors of online program managers of online there were. Like,
I wonder if it's scraping the Internet Archive. That's early, you know.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's anything in there from that institution's website in the Internet Archive about their staffing. Staffing is always a really interesting area for me. Mm-hmm. That my dissertation, which is about how small institutions adapted online instructional technology is what we called it then. We didn't call it ed tech yet. But the staffing was part of what I looked at. I always found, because I was in a place where we had what we call the liaison model. I liaise with a certain column, a certain silo of a discipline. I'm in a disciplinary corridor. Yet there were some that were expertise focused. I only do, web projects. I do media projects for programs and faculty members. I do this or that. So they're very expertise focused. So staffing has really always been a really interesting subject for me, and how we do this. Even now, in the where I am at the University of Minnesota, how do we staff for our team and other spaces? How do we staff to help online programs develop and scale?
Mm-hmm. You know, I had a question for you about, like, you know, I know, you know, you completed your master's in history, and then eventually you got your your doctorate in education, you know, higher ed. I'm wondering for you, just given the fact that you know, after you got your master's and you started working full time, like if you hadn't gone back to graduate school, do you think your path would have been somewhat similar in the sense that you were, you know, open to collaborating with others, you saw the future of the use of technology? Like, do you think the doctorate kind of helped you or not? Like, in some ways, because I bring up the question because sometimes I get asked, like, oh, do I need to get a doctorate in order to do what you do now?
Right.
And I struggle a bit with that because I think it allowed me to be in the room where it happens, right? But right. Then you just talked about how, hey, you were already a staff member, so you were allowed to join these meetings and conversations and to build trust with faculty. So I'd love to hear your thoughts about whether or not that going back to graduate school was, you know, helpful versus maybe just in a parallel universe where you didn't do that. Would you see that version of you still being successful in doing cool things?
I struggled with, as I'm doing the PhD in higher ed policy administration, why am I doing this? Is it just for me, my own edification? Why am I doing this? But it was a strategic move in ways. I wanted a PhD because I wanted to do the research. I like the research. And I wanted, basically, if I was going to be in this space in higher ed and not have gone a faculty route, I wanted to have a doctorate because I wanted to have a credential that's sort of not unassailable, but undeniable. And I remember asking Andy Overman again at McAllister. We'd sit in his office a lot and talk or just have coffee. And I remember one of the points where I'm like, this is a really long path. I'm in the middle of it and it's hard. I like it, but oof, you know, I'm like years into this thing. Should I continue? Does it matter? And he said, yes, it matters. It matters in an academic institution because it means you get it. You get you get the research enterprise. You understand what that takes. You can speak to these things. I mean, in higher ed, you have to be able to speak largely from experience when you're in those settings, administrative, academic, et cetera, even staff, you have to have experience, which is why when we talk about in our episode about why we're doing this, one of the things I'm going to say is like, we have experience, the three of us. To me, it's hard for people to come in and say higher ed should do this when they've barely ever had a cup of coffee in an institution. They've been adjacent or never in one. I struggle with that. That's where I'm like, shh. But he said, look, it matters. This matters a lot. And we'll talk about this at some point, but I'll drop it in now. All three of us are in the Fulbright Specials program. Kevin is a recent addition to the roster for that really excellent program. You, Kelvin, and I have been through it. We've gotten our grants and done experiences. That PhD, that doctorate was really important then, mm-hmm. To be able to get into that program. You don't have to have one to do it. But you know, I wanted it to, because that's what I thought it would really do for me. So, but I do occasionally people ask me about, should I do a doctorate in this or that? And I tell them, first of all, don't borrow any money to do it. I try to pass the helpful wisdom along I got. And that it's a slog. It's going to be hard. You're going to doubt yourself at a lot of moments. But in a lot of ways, it's a calculated move. You have to make that calculation. I can't say, oh, you should totally do this, or no, you should not. I met at a listening session for our upcoming strategic plan at the university. I went to a collaborative workshop. What should we focus on? And there was a student who was just finishing she was a doctoral student in history, American history at the University of Minnesota. And she was also then like, she's like, I want to go to law school too. And in my brain, I'm like, not to be totally pragmatic, like, what are you going to do with that? But I'm like, where do you envision that taking you? And is all that needed in a world that is in the world in higher ed now that is unkind to faculty? There are, you know, faculty is a is a profession, is it's a very hard space to be in. So, but I tell people, you have to make that choice. I can give you my perspectives, but it is really your calculated move. Mm-hmm. You have to envision that space that you want to be in, that you think is the place for you. For me, it was the intersection of technology and higher education and academics and research. And I was, I was alive at a time when there was a growing need for that. And people who were like, how do we get into this now? How do we get into this? Oh, you're interested and you have some basic proficiency and competency. You know, another important person for me, Dr. Elaine Berlin, she was the associate dean at the College of Arts and Sciences at the time at Washington University. She was like, you do this stuff, great. I'm going to take you and I'm going to have you doing these workshops and doing this and that. She was great. She was a wonderful, wonderful mentor and supporter.
So I love all that. I think there's two pieces to it, right? So there's, is the doctorate necessary for the things that we do? And I think that's the big broad question, right? Like, do you have to have a doctorate to do these things? So where I was kind of going with the idea of the doctorate is the question of, is it necessary for the things that we do? Or have we created these degrees at this level because we just think that's the right thing to do? So, So I'll use nursing as a really good example. You can get an associate's degree. You can get an ASN, Associate of Science in Nursing. You're an RN. You are a registered nurse. You take the qualifying exams. You can do everything that a nurse can do. And then we went and we created the Master of Science in Nursing for people who want a little bit more, or we also had the Bachelor of Science in Nursing. And so now, in the past 5 or so years, all these hospitals are coming back with their accreditation standards for running a hospital and saying, well, you're not going to be as accredited or as valued if you have a whole bunch of ASNs running around. So they all need to go get a BSN. And so we as higher ed went and created through our accrediting bodies for CCNE and others and said, okay, well, here's the pathway to go from an ASN to a BSN. It doesn't give you any more clinical work. It's all classroom. It's all didactic classwork. Work, right? To get a bachelor's degree. You already know everything at the associate's level. And then we do the master's, and then we do the DNP.
Yep.
Right? So we've just created these pathways of just move, like,
oh yeah. Physical therapy is the same way.
Your wife is a physical therapist.
She's a DBT.
They used to have a bachelor's degree.
Right.
Then it went to master's. And then it went to doctorate, and we got rid of all the other pathways in between.
Yeah, yeah. She was one of the first classes. WashU went in early on the doctor of physical therapy. So the class of 05 was one of the first. I think class of 04 or 03 was the first one. They are all in on the DBT. And now what's really fascinating to her and frustrating, she's 20 years into her career on the nose, is that it's not giving her the professional opportunities she really wants, which is to branch off the clinical work into the quality assessment, quality improvement. She's finding that, you know, people with bachelors of nursing and maybe masters are having more opportunities because, honestly, I don't know why. Because they have, I don't know. It's really fascinating. So I think there's in some fields, it's like degree inflation. What is all that extra getting you? So I think it's a great question about in our world of higher ed, especially on the non-faculty, the staff side, administrative side. Do you need a doctorate? What does it get you? Here's something I haven't thought about it this until this moment you brought it up. I don't think, so I am an adjacent. I came, met bachelor's in history, non-declared minor in jazz studies, master's in history, American history, doctorate in PhD in higher education policy administration. I don't think going around is as easy now. Like, if let's say I got a PhD in history or I had a PhD in psychology, like Kelvin, could someone in a non-technological field? I mean, do you have to have a PhD or a master's in instructional design now to get into those spaces? Because that's the space where I see so many people going. Instructional design, ID, ID, ID. Could I even crack into that space. Frankly, I wouldn't want to. I've kind of done instructional design stuff. I wouldn't want to do that. I don't want to be doing Canvas and all that crap anymore.
But yeah, but I think we
would we have a shot? We were in the time when like it was like a wide open Wild West. Like we need people doing this. We don't know. There were no technical academic degrees to get there. You came in with some sort of adjacent disciplinary background.
Right.
History or otherwise.
Yeah.
I mean, look at a lot of the people that run online programs. I mean, they came through the academic route of a PhD, have no training in the technology side, have no training in the LMS side. But because many of those positions were tied to delivering of an academic program. And so that resides with the faculty, right?
So, but I think there's still, for those kind of roles, there's immense value because, and you're an example of this, you've taught a lot. My boss, Eric Watkins, is a horticulture professor. He's actually only 0.6 as the vice provost of distributed learning. He's 0.4. He's still in the College of, you know, Food, Agricultural, and Natural Sciences. He does turf grass research. So he gives me free lawn advice. It's great. But his experience teaching online is one of the reasons that helped him get that role and his teaching experience. And he knows how programs are, program approval processes, course approvals, because he has that from all of his academic years that you would never, as just a purely administrative technical, let's say academic technology route, you would never get that implicit in the weeds experience. So that's where it's like calculated decision. You want to get this, you want to go this route. You got to just roll your dice on what you think is right. And obviously talking to a lot of people about how did you get there?
Yeah. But so I guess the other thing I was kind of thinking is, I think it also kind of depends on what you want to do, right?
Yes.
Like I think to answer Kelvin's original question, which was, did you really need the PhD to do what you were doing? And could you have continued on that path? I think the answer is yes, but for you to move up in the organ, like it's almost like there's like these hanging chads, right? Of you want to move up. So you need to have a certain credential or you need to have a degree or, you know, you can't be like, I used to be at a community college where you couldn't be a dean unless you had a doctorate degree, right? Like it was just a line drawn in the sand. It didn't matter how many years of experience you had. Didn't matter how much you did instruction. Didn't matter what, like, but that was just the line in the sand. If you want to be a dean, you have to have a PhD. You have to have a doctorate. So it's kind of like that same thing, right? Like you are doing really well in the world that you were in with the credentials that you had, but did you need that to get to the next level?
No one told me you need it. It was, again, it was something where I don't want this to sound arrogant, but I wanted a credential that when I walked in a room with deans, provosts, vice provosts, faculty, that it was to signal something that I know what your world is like. I'm not going to purport to be that. I would never purport to be a faculty member. I haven't taught a ton. I would love to teach more. I've tried to like adjunct this and that. And it just hasn't worked out. I've done a little bit. So I did some pre and first semester of COVID this spring of 20. I taught a little one credit course that was a hoot about like data, data analytics, telling stories with data. But I don't have the teaching chops to really say, oh, I've got faculty experience. And I don't do that. I would never, because I'd probably fall flat on that. But, you know, I wanted to send a signal. If I'm going to try to really climb up in an academic space, I want the credential that rhymes, that harmonizes with most other people in the room.
And I think that's the key, the academic space.
Yes.
Right? Like, I think that's, Calvin can probably weigh in more on this more than I can, because I've not tried the tenure track either. But I also think I'm just talking biases, right? Like biases within the world of higher ed. And I think there are biases, even if you have a doctorate, if you didn't go through the tenure track process, you're still not quite seen the same way because that took a different rigor, that took a different element of work and all of those types of things. But that's just kind of my lens of faculty that I've worked with at a ton of different institutions, you know.
And, well, and I think this might be
having those conversations was still kind of like, well, you know, this is how we do it here in the engineering program. And it's like, well, yes, but curriculum is curriculum at the end of the day.
Kevin, what were you going to hop in with? Because I can segue into something. I'm not hearing you right now.
We lost your sound, Kelvin.
Sorry about that. Ah. Yeah, no, you all brought up a good thing too about like thinking about the culture. Like, for example, another example is like college presidents, right? There are many schools where a college president doesn't have to have a doctorate, but then there's faculty pressure because they want to have someone at that in that role that looks like them, right?
Or at least understands the academic enterprise from. They've walked the walks.
From their,
can talk the talk.
Yeah. Yeah. So I totally get that. I mean, I worked for a community college where I was really pushing to try to get a promotion because I, you know, we were expecting our first child, our daughter, Kate. And I was told that like my boss was very supportive about me being a dean. But then I think, you know, we had this similar conversation about, well, even though you have a PhD, you know, you haven't really been in a tenure track role. And it was only later where I think they decided to maybe create more of an executive director role, which would have been, so I wish I can go back in time and had advocated for myself. How about,
hey, here's a different title you can think about.
Right.
Well, so here, this actually is a good segue to the next phase of my career. So I, 2017, first of all, I had this amazing experience. The spring of 2017, the CTO at Carleton College, Janet Scannell, who's still there, the CIO at the time at McAllister, Jerry Sanders, she had this idea of doing a job swap. She wanted to take me for 3 months down to Carleton College, which is like 40 miles away in Northfield, charming little town. And then she was going to send Austin Robinson Coolidge, who was a tech director on her team, to McAllister. We were going to switch roles for 3 months. So going down there would give me a chance to manage a team and manage budgets and all sorts of other stuff. And for Austin, it would give him experience being right next to faculty, right along with them, and supporting the academic enterprise more so than he was in his role down at Carleton. So that was a great experience. So for 3 months, I hoofed it down to Carleton every day and got to learn a ton from her and the people on the teams, the team that I managed, who were very generous to let me come in and, you know, to do that role. It was funny. Janet said, she's like, I was like, what can I do? What are the limits? She's like, well, you can't fire anybody, but you can pretty much do anything else. So, oh, great. Okay. So that gave me a lot of insights. But in 2017, I was ready to move on from McAllister, partly because, honestly, as much as I adored being in a small liberal arts environment, I went to a college in a place like that. Most of my career was there. WashU was a bigger institution, but I loved McAllister. But small liberal arts colleges the pressure was already on them then financially. And I felt like I don't want to just be relevant in that small slice of higher ed. I mean, I think SLACs, as we call them, small liberal arts colleges, I think they graduate maybe 1 to 1.5% of all college graduates every year. It's tiny.
Yeah.
So even though there's a lot of institutions, they're small. So I didn't want to only be relevant in that space. And I felt like it was a space that was starting to, you know, the ocean's rising on them, or it's eroding that little island. So I secured a role at the University of Minnesota in the College of Liberal Arts as a academic technology staff person. One of the big pushes was they were going to transition from Moodle to Canvas over like a 2-year run. And they wanted someone who, I mean, I had been immersed in Moodle for years at McAllister, and even there was like a Moodle, I want to say it was a board, but I was treasurer for this, like the US Moodle community. So I knew Moodle in and out as far as an admin and teaching. So, and that was a great opportunity because it's a space I'm comfortable with, so it's liberal arts disciplines. I did get to work with faculty a lot. And I also, this is when I really, yet another space where I'm like, ooh, there's some opportunity there. I dove in and became a Tableau, I'm not going to say an expert, but I came really dangerous because we're a small team. There was like three technologists like me, and we had a team lead who was one of my better bosses ever, Chris Lopez. We have a huge, biggest college in the system, bigger than every other campus, really. How are we going to eat this elephant? Tons of Moodle use. Got to go to Canvas. We have a 2-year space. People like CLA, that college, they're not going to make it. There's too much to do. So what I did is I figured out how to make a dashboard that showed us what we had in Moodle, the presence of courses with content by department, by everything, all these factors, where we needed to go so that we could manage this transition. Oh, that department has tons of Moodle use. We need to go in there and figure out how to do it. It used to be a come as you are shop for the academic technology. You come to us, faculty, you come to us. My argument was, no, we need to divide this up by disciplinary corridors. We each take a corridor, and then we really make relationships, beat the pavement, make relationships in those departments so that we can make this transition happen. And so, you know, it was a stepwise adoption. Every semester in the run-up, we could see who's doing it. I'd had a daily, like an hourly feed from Canvas. Who's editing? Who's not? Who's doing stuff? So then we knew, okay, we need to go to that department and give them a workshop or just make ourselves available or that particular liaison available. And it worked. Fall of 19, we were ready to go with the cutoff. Moodle's done. We were good. We had like a brief cup of coffee and then COVID hit in the early 2020. It was awful. Just as far as workload and insanity.
So Fritz, were they using Moodle for supplemental or was that their actual online courses?
Well, the College of Liberal Arts had very few at that point, almost no online courses pre-COVID. So it was very much a complement and a supplement to in-person instruction. So, I'm starting to scratch at something. Like I've been a long time, 19, 17 years in the ed tech space. I'll be honest, I was getting bored with it because in the early 2000s, we were building things. And I only came to this realization recently. We were building things, building stuff for teaching, building stuff for research. Now in Canvas, it's like, everyone, we're going to implement a new font. I'm like, okay, it became so incremental that it stopped piquing my interest in my innovative brain. So along the way, and this is part of the doctorate, I was becoming more interested in the bigger questions. Like, how do we adapt to this online space in a way that still, you know, the values and the history and the traditions and the good things about liberal arts and humanities and all those things that carry forward and go into that space. So we're not just, you know, becoming overlorded by the technology. So I wanted to get into that space. And I was frankly having some challenges because, again, my background was all in this ed tech space. So after the brutal experience of COVID, and this is about when we became acquainted, Kevin, is I took a vice president role at a small OPM, online program management company called Relearn It. I was there for about a year and a half. Part of it was a very strategic move because I wanted to gain more experience on that, you know, within the online space, meaning building programs, administering them. And that gave me a lot of experience I needed because I was writing contracts. I'm on the other side of the table now. So I have all this knowledge about how higher education works from the inside. And now I could bring that experience to bear on creating relationships and programs and frankly, scaling those programs. So I wanted to do that. And I knew I wouldn't be there forever, but I wanted to do that so that I could then keep growing in that space. I wanted to transition away from doing ed tech and academic technology in the institutional space to these bigger questions about how do we develop this online program space, not just post COVID, but in general, like how do we do this? And because to me, it's not the only future of higher ed, but it is going to be a big part of it. And I wanted to be in that space. Again, I wasn't the only one seeing this, but I could see the opportunity there. I'm like, how do I get there? And like, I have to make a leap out. I'm not getting the opportunities in, so I need to make a leap out to elevate. And Kelvin, you and both of you, Kevin, you're you've done this a lot more than me, but you've moved out to move up, moved out of an institution to a company or to another institution. So that's what I did. So then early 2023, I wanted to, you know, I it was time to move to a new space. So I left ReLearnIt and I was able to get this role in the Office of Distributed Learning at the University of Minnesota. So we are part of the provost's office. We're very small. We have our vice provost of distributed learning. We have our assistant vice provost who does a lot of the policy and the state reg stuff. And frankly, just a lot of opportunity sifting across the system. There's me, I'm an analyst. And then Paula McDonald, who is another analyst who leads a lot of our, she leads a pilot for degree completion. And she's also doing a lot of project management in as we're supporting online programs. So I got a long story. We're at an hour and 2 minutes into this. That's how I've arrived at this moment is this. It's kind of been meandering, but it's been a fun ride so far. And I'm just turning 50. So I have a lot more ride left if I hope to retire.
No, it's good. I mean, I think, you know, you've really always been, and correct me if this isn't correct, but you've always been connected to technology. Like you got early into, hey, you know, Y2K web development as part of the things that you've been doing. So like you haven't really left that technology space.
It's true.
And yeah. I would say I'm similar to that, right? Yeah. Like when my first job at Arkansas was technology related, and I've really not ever gotten out of that space. And Kelvin's probably the opposite of us a little bit, where like you kind of fell into that online world as part of your faculty role,
right?
Leadership role in that space. And so,
but then I feel like once you did, Kelvin, you started really pulling, not even a string, you started pulling a rope.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, it's an ecosystem play, or at least that's what I kind of realized.
Yeah.
Back then, and even now in my micro-credentialing work now, like it's bigger than just like I need a technology for a course. Like I realized because of the online programs, like, man, you got to think bigger. Like you got to think about the LMS, you got to think about the SIS, how it interacts.
Yep.
Then you got to like figure out what other technologies can you use to support student services. So yeah, it's almost like a drug. Like you kind of get addicted to like, oh man, totally. You got to like solve for all these different things.
So that tells you the path of how I've got here. Not really the why. I mean, the why am I still in higher ed? Because there's a lot going on in technology that this plays in. And you've both been at in organizations, companies that are, they're connected to higher ed, but you know, where you're supporting higher ed from the outside, but there's a lot of opportunity. I mean, there's big salaries and all that. Why am I still at institutions? Why do I do this? To me, this is about being in higher ed is about, to me, this is the right place for me to feel like I'm contributing something positive to the future, helping people at the end of the day, whatever level they are, learner, 18 to 22 and adults, et cetera, graduate students, certificates, whatever, workforce development. It's how I feel like I'm best suited to contribute to the positive things that can happen for those people in that space. And that's important to me. That helps drive me. That got me through. And I was like, why am I doing a PhD again? Like, am I going to finish this one? My wife's like, honey, it's been 6 years. Are you going to finish this thing? So that's really what it is for me, is that I feel like I'm contributing to something positive. I have, you know, like everyone's got to look in the mirror every day. And that helps me look in the mirror and be like, yeah, you know, this is the right kind of fit for you. And to me it is, this is the space that's most fascinating to me. So, you know, I do the market research for a lot of these programs. I'm not a macroeconomist, but now I feel like, and Kelvin, I know you do this a lot. You too, Kevin, but you're like, how in the world do we figure out what is the right thing to offer so that when people take that thing, whether it's a micro-credential or a degree of some level, that's going to prep them not just for a job, but a career, a life that they can adapt to, because you have to be able to adapt faster and faster, it seems. So that to me is, that is like, it's like the ultimate puzzle. every day I feel like I'm trying to solve a puzzle. I'm trying to not close my eyes, but we're trying to throw these javelins out into space. And so they hit the bullseye that's moving around. You know, there's a great article I read this weekend about an economist saying AI is not what's keeping early career people from getting jobs. The economy is sputtering. We've just missed the signals of it. And companies are investing in AI, literally the chips, the NVIDIA chips, because it's a safer bet, though expensive, than hiring when they're terrified to hire right now because of all the uncertainty in the economy, because of tariffs and all sorts of other things. So to me, that's like, those are the things I dig for, because I'm trying to figure out, well, that is a computer science degree worth it now, given the you know, AI is coming for every job mentality, except for plumbers, carpenters, and electricians, apparently. And so it makes it really fascinating. You want to get it right. You got to get it right for the sake of the people who are going to invest in their education. And we're a public institution. The state's going to invest money at some level, hopefully. So it's a great space to be in. I love it.
I would agree. And just Calvin mentioning micro-credentials. I love right now the fact that I am dabbling in both degree programs and the micro-credential space, and having those conversations to really say, how can we embed some other little things into academic programs to give our students a leg up, right? Like having that conversation with the history department to say, what if they learned data analytics? Like, what if they had the opportunity to get data analytics as part of a research class that they were doing, or something else, or learn AI, or anything that's kind of elevate them just a little bit more.
And you know, what's funny is that is the experience I had as an undergrad. So I graduated from high school in 94, went to DePauw at that point, and I know it still is. I'm not the most involved alum, but part of DePauw was you do internships, no matter what you're doing. You have winter term, you do internships, you do things, you bolt things on to that experience of your history degree. So I'm doing history stuff, I'm writing thesis paper, et cetera, et cetera. But you know, that's the reason I got a job at Anderson Consulting is, hey, he's good in math, he's done internships. Like I interned at a jazz club in St. Louis, I think my senior year for winter term. I'm writing press releases, I'm driving artists around to radio interviews. That's great. So that is why I had a future. It's not because I had a bachelor's piece of paper. I mean, yes, I could write really well as a history student. But to me, every degree, especially bachelor's, you have to bolt things onto it that show your applied ability. So like you're saying, data analytics as part of a history degree or a humanities degree? Yeah, absolutely. Because that shows you can apply things. And it's not to mean you're just you're somehow like beholden to, you're just going to go work in a corporation or whether you want to or not. It gives you the ability to adapt. And that's what you have to do. Because you can do a comp sci degree or a physics degree and not bolt anything onto it and be as equally irrelevant as a history major or whatever. Like you can be irrelevant in any field. So it's what you bolt onto it. So I tell people who are like, oh, I'm going to go get a bachelor's, this or that. I tell them, double major or minor in something practical or very relevant right now, because that makes you broadly appealing in your career. You broaden your career horizon. So,
yeah, that's the tag, part of the tagline of our work with micro-credentials, broadly educated, specifically skilled.
Oh yeah.
So
that's awesome. I like that.
Trademark. Yeah. I'll put a trademark in the,
I say you need to trademark that so somebody doesn't take it.
Yeah, seriously.
So, I don't know what the next phase will be for my, I'm saying I don't know. I know what I want my next phase of my career to look like more of, but, this is one that job exchange and one of the reasons I'm really thankful for, Janet Scannell pushing for this and all the mentoring she gave to me is that I came to understand the difference between leadership and management. And I've managed people now. I managed a team at at the College of Liberal Arts at the university for a while when I was there for those 3.5-4 years. I managed people at ReLearnIt. I did it great. One person told me at ReLearnIt, it was really kind. She said, "You're the best boss I've ever had." That was really, really thoughtful. I will always appreciate her saying that. But I realized that, you know, you can't really do both full tilt. You got to kind of pick one. And I'd rather be in a space where I am now, where I'm connecting things, I'm tinkering, but I'm not managing a big team. Because if you're going to manage people well and be really good to them as a manager, you got to be really devoted to that. You can't half-ass it, because they know, and you don't do right by them. You stall their career out while you're standing on their shoulders or their faces. Because I've had my face stood on while someone's managing poorly and trying to elevate themselves. So I like the leadership side, where, you know, you're getting to knit these things together and push the envelope into spaces. I think that's a better fit for me. I like mentoring people a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I did the UPSIA mentoring, and I think it was great to be part of that mentoring opportunity.
Were a mentor.
I was a mentor for someone in UPSIA. I would even be a mentee if I could get the right mentor.
Yeah.
Not even in this space, but I've also played around with doing, and it's not to try to get into a provost role, but to do like the ASCU Provost Institute or some other provost institutes, just to get kind of like exactly what you're talking about, like just how to start to think about things in a different way, just to put a different lens on stuff, rather than, oh, I'm going to do this because I want to become a provost, but more of just, what's the skill sets that I'm missing, you know, that would make me a better manager and leader at my organization.
And maybe this will be the place where I do it, but I don't have a mentor right now with the pace of things and life and stuff. That's something I'm lacking. So this has gotten me thinking about it again.
Yeah.
Maybe you two will be my mentors, because you.
Yeah,
it's what mentors.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll just be in your organizations.
We'll just be the podcast mentor group, and we'll just kind of shepherd you along. But with that, Fritz, I mean, this was great getting to know you, hearing about your background and how you got to where you are. And I hope everyone that's listening to this really feels like they're connected to Fritz now. And we look forward to having more presentations and more podcasts and talking about other things about getting stuff done in higher ed.
And I'm excited to, now that we get this out of the way of talking about ourselves, now we can start talking about stuff, getting stuff done. We can talk to people. We can talk about really important topics now.
Exactly. Great. Well, thanks everyone for tuning in, and we'll check you out in the next podcast. Mm-hmm.